Welcome to the Doctor Who Review Show 2015.
Okay, what did you love about that episode?
I thought when that electric guitar kicked in the theme music, oh, I thought that was the best thing that had ever happened.
I did like that the Fisher King walked with a purpose. Okay. That was, he wasn't trying to get anywhere because he didn't really care. He was just like, yeah.
You look good.
I am the Fisher King.
Oh, yeah.
I totally loved that intro. It was probably one of my favorite Doctor Who intros ever. The Doctor totally rocking it with his Beethoven. Oh, I just loved it so much. I want to kiss it to death. And then, you know, the rockified intro. Awesome!
I quite like the way in which the story overall hid a lot of its clues in plain sight so that the viewer with a bit of imagination or the viewer who's really following the story and thinking about where it might go can feel a small victory here and there as their predictions come true. I guess the obvious one for a lot of people was the box and how that might be a conduit for the Doctor to travel from 150 years in the past, I believe, to the present, because using the TARDIS would be just so passé.
When they were on the phone to each other, I just thought it was a really beautiful moment. And when the Doctor called and said, all right, yeah, I'll come back for you. I won't leave you.
I did like how the Doctor looked at us, like, straight on into the camera and educated us about time travel concepts. It was cool. I felt like a companion, you know?
The only thing I didn't really like was the ending felt rather rushed and convenient, and I suppose it was always going to.
What didn't you like?
I thought O'Donnell's death was clumsily handled and unnecessary.
I know. So I was trying to think of something else so I could let you have that one.
I didn't like the Fisher King. His movement is so awkward, and the sounds he makes, this really loud, vibrating thud, there was no way he was heavy enough to make that much noise. I mean, that was a loud noise. Do you know how much that takes to make that kind of noise when just stepping on grass and dirt? And I didn't like how his overhanging cape thing, like, shook awkwardly. It wobbled when he walked. I don't think any fierce warlord should have a wobbly, overhanging cape thing. It's just not right.
The only thing that I didn't love was the fact that I had to watch it twice to get my head around the time travel.
You know, there's not a whole lot in this episode to dislike. If I had to pick on something, it would be, you know, a bit of a stretch, but it would probably be something along the lines of the death of O'Donnell, because I quite liked Morven Christie's portrayal there.
I thought there was some really great character development with these past two episodes, particularly Cass and Lun. I also really liked O'Donnell, but I was very disappointed and sad when she died. That was probably my least favorite part of the episode.
What raised questions?
Well, batteries.
Isn't that what batteries
on the
do?
Whole, can't be used as explosive devices.
You're just not doing them right. You've got some fun lessons in chemistry coming up soon.
They don't have any moving parts. I don't know why that battery had, you know, the typical self-destruction button that I would expect from, you know, a giant man-eating robot.
Questions. I thought that this one still kind of had too many unanswered questions. For instance, the metal thing, why were they able to handle metal? Was this answered and I just missed it? Can one of you guys let me know?
I'm sure a lot of people out there have a billion timey-wimey questions, but I'll take a different route here and just say simply, hey, Fisher King, you're this smart guy, you've got this huge plan to invade the Earth, and it's quite complex, you're obviously a thinker. A dam is bursting, it's going to take an awfully long time to reach you. Meanwhile, there's a spaceship just about 10-15 metres to your right. Do I need to finish that sentence?
I wanted to know more about the Fisher King. How did he come back to life? Why did people think he was dead when he really, really wasn't? And, you know, what was his backstory?
I'm also interested to know who the Minister of War is and what's that all about, because it's very 1984, but George Orwell.
Some fantastic questions were raised. I think maybe we're seeing that the series arc is going to be, who is it who's rewriting or rearranging time? Someone, perhaps, I don't know, meddling with time?
And who might you be?
I am the master. I am the master, and you will obey me.
Oh, yes. Oh, that would be ever so nice. Will you oppress me? Will you dominate me?
No. I think you're a bit weird.
Hi, it's Ian here, and I'm going to reach through the screen and poke my finger into the internet, and yep, that feels like a fairly divisive episode, by which I mean an awful lot of people appear not to have liked Before the Flood very much. And I think the main... Well, there are two main criticisms. Well, there are three main criticisms. There is... they don't like the idea of the Doctor talking directly to the camera in the teaser. Fine, that is divisive. I thought it was brilliant. I wouldn't want to see it every week, but at the same time, I thought that was absolutely gorgeous. It was just like the start of Listen, but more kind of clever and more enjoyable. The second thing that seems to have divided people is they don't like the idea of electric guitar over the opening credits. I think those people are wrong. I have to say that that's probably the greatest thing that's ever happened, and I loved it. And if it's not there next week, I'm going to be very upset. The third thing that seems to have divided people is that no one seems to really understand the plot of Before the Flood. It depends, I think, how you watch television, and there are a number of ways of approaching this, consciously and unconsciously, subconsciously, and people are either passive viewers or active viewers. An active viewer is someone who will sit there and perhaps as a writer or someone interested in writing, you're focused on the script and the mechanics of the script and making sure that everything pays off and makes sense and that the dialogue is cracking and everything is paced wonderfully. Whereas a more passive viewer will sit there, look at the pretty pictures for 45 minutes, and if they feel like they've been told a story, they will be happy. These days, I've sort of become a passive viewer, like I was when I was seven. So it's the same experience watching Before the Flood as it was watching, The Mark of the Rani. You know, it feels like you're being told a story because you're being given a beginning, a middle, and an end with Before the Flood. You see that the characters understand that they've had a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. They sort of know what's gone on. So unquestioningly, I think, okay, fine, that was a story. That was fine. They're happy with the resolution. I'm happy with the resolution. It felt like it was story shaped. If you actually break down the time travel-y plot of that episode and put your finger on any specific point of it and then try and plot the full story in a circle of time, you know, sort of, we're here, this happens, this happens, this happens, the Doctor works this out, he puts himself in this freezer unit, he then stays in that for 36 years and is rescued by the base, and then Clara lets him out and everyone on the base has been killed by the thing that he drowned 30 years ago. And it breaks down. And it's the same problem you'd get with, 8 out of 10 episodes of Red Dwarf, where, because it's a sitcom primarily, and because it's there for entertainment, and it's, you know, it's not being written by a quantum physicist, it's being written by comedy writers, sometimes the plots and stories in Red Dwarf don't entirely hang together in a consistent way. It's also a problem with some of the Back to the Future films, specifically the middle one, Hello, and Terminator 3. All Terminator films since Terminator 2. Terminator 2 was fine. Everything that's come afterwards has been problematic and plain wrong. And watching Terminator Genesis this summer, I think, is the sort of ultimate example of something where you're sitting there and looking at it and you sort of consciously think, no, I'm not going to try and follow this. I'm just going to try and be there in body and spirit for the last 5 minutes when I'm sure this will all make sense. And it doesn't make sense. And the franchise disappears up the cosmic sphincter and Matt Smith is now out of work. Maybe you should have stayed in Doctor Who, Mr. Smith. Ooh. But active viewing will get you so far, but ultimately you're always going to come up against something that makes you feel stupid. I remember watching The Sopranos and there'd be some lingering camera shots on someone's face or on an object or on a reaction to something someone said. Lots and lots of these moments that made me personally think, I don't get the significance of this. I'm obviously a fool and I'm missing the greater significance. I'm missing a reference or I'm missing something massive and clever. And I don't know that that's necessarily the case. I mean, one of the great things about having DVDs is you can go back and watch things like The Sopranos with the subtitles and work out what people are actually saying. And often it's not quite as clever as you necessarily think it is. It's just very well acted. And I remember also things like GBH in the 90s. I'd try and follow that. And I would come away from it. And it felt like a drama. But even at the age of whatever I was, you know, sort of early teens, I wasn't quite convinced by the ending. And that holds true now. So I think most television is kind of, if you don't get it on that first broadcast, you're not going to get it. If it's not good enough on that first broadcast, it's not going to get better with repeated viewing. And television should never be designed to get better with repeated viewing. Sure, it can be quite densely packed and there are layers that you can unlock the more you watch it and the more you invest in it. But I don't think anyone would ever get anywhere in the industry by trying to make television that required 3 or 4 viewings. Because 95% of the audience aren't going to give it a second viewing. Take shows that I love at the moment. There's a point in Orphan Black there's a point in Orphan Black somewhere near the end of the second series where it starts looking at the sharks and tying on its jump shoes and athletically limbering up. But before that happened, it got to, I mean, season one was the most amazing and fantastically written and paced drama that just kept you watching. It was an absolutely unputdownable thriller on TV. You could not stop watching it. If I'd had to watch that 1 week at a time, I'd have gone mad. But in season two, it suddenly becomes so complex and there are so many levels to the kind of conspiracy and the hierarchy of the organization responsible for what's going on in that show that you just think, I'm going to stop following this now and just look at the pretty pictures and enjoy the funny lines. And that can be what happens, sadly. And I think a lot of people that most of us who listen to podcasts will listen to lots of podcasts, and I'm subscribed to more Doctor Who podcasts than is strictly healthy or normal. Hello to everyone. And a lot of people are looking at Before the Flood and going, but this wouldn't have made sense. He couldn't have gone back here. How would he have known the order that people died in? How did he manage to do this? How did he make the hologram? Where was he when he made the hologram? How long was he in the box? And I think fundamentally these are grown, even middle-aged people saying these things and asking these questions. And if we don't get it, then a 7-year-old is not going to be able to sit there and talk to you about causal loops and the temporal nexus. What a 7-year-old will say to you is, the man went back in time and he did the thing and he got in the box and he came back and it was all sorted out. Because 7-year-olds are who this show ought to be being written for. And as long as they feel like they've had a good story, then that's all that matters. But, you know, electric guitar over the credits? Yes, please.
Absolutely fine.
Oh, why are you all right?
Because I've watched Doctor Who.
Okay, we both watched Doctor Who. Did you have a pile of cards there like the Doctor had last week?
I've got post-it notes galore. You can't see them, but oh well, we'll start because we've got to be quirky. What do you think of Albert Prentice, the little mole man?
Oh, the little mole man.
It reminded me of Narnia as soon as I saw him. I thought it was
Mr. Tumnus
like that.
Mr. Beaver.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, well, you liked him then, did you?
I did quite like it. It was quite sinister. Yeah, I thought it was a bit weird the way he came over. It was quite creepy, but I liked him as a character. It was quite fun.
What's the next post-it there? What else we got?
I mean, the other thing, which I've just got to mention, was Clara's outfit this week was fantastic. I'm going shopping immediately.
Yellow blouse and sort of
like a tartan dress, yeah. I'm going Clara chic for autumn.
Oh, she does look good, doesn't she, Clara?
Definitely. I'm warming to her. I like her. This series, I really like her. You've always been a fan.
Well, it's funny. It swings and roundabouts with Clara because other people are going away from her. I'm still exactly as I've always been with Clara. I do love her.
Mm.
She's no Amy Pond, you know.
No, she's no Amy Pond. There'll never be another Amy Pond.
God, no.
What was the name of the monster? What was that called?
The Fisher King.
Yeah, the Fisher King. He was very well spoken, wasn't he? American audience would be creased because he was the most British monster that you could ever imagine. He may as well have been holding a cup of tea.
Wouldn't it be good if we could get I want a quest now for an even more well-spoken monster, the biggest, nastiest-looking monster ever that just stands there going, oh, I really think it's time we disintegrated this planet now, don't you? I say, these ginger nuts are absolutely spiffing.
Nice to have a posh monster every now and again. Oh, what else have I got on my notes? Does the bootstrap paradox actually exist? I'm yet to Google it.
Well, I'm glad you've asked me that, because this is I didn't think it would be in our section, but this will be the only section I can mention this in this week. It comes from, it's a novella. It's like a 30-page story that was published in a sci-fi magazine. Astounding Science Fiction, which is the longest-running science fiction magazine. I think it started in something like 1913 in America, maybe even before. And lots of famous writers like Isaac Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke, they had stories in it. And there's this guy called Robert A. Heinlein. I can't say his name. Heinlein. Rather cleverly, in the magazine, he put down that he had a pseudonym, which was Anson MacDonald, so we'll stick with that.
that's easier.
Anyway, in 1941, he had this story in it called By His Bootstraps, which is all about this bloke called Bob Wilson, who was writing a science maths paper in a locked room, Jonathan Creek style, and all of a sudden he's aware that someone else is in the room with him, and it's someone who has travelled from the future. So, don't Google the bootstrap paradox, everyone. Google By His Bootstraps and you get a great story. I was going to read it and put it on the podcast, but it'd take about half an hour to read. So I thought, probably too long. So yeah, it came in this book. So yeah, you could read it, and it's like a little additional thing.
Yeah, treats. Excellent. I mean, that was the main bit I had to watch twice because I was like, what?
Yeah.
How? What? It was a complete head mess, but I think I get it. I think. I don't know what happened to Future Doctor, the one that was half an hour ahead. When did he? Oh,
blowing my mind.
I think there's a missing scene. In fact, Al pointed this out to me when I was having a chat with him the other night, and that was that the Doctor got to the dam very fast to blow it up.
Yes!
Maybe that was the Doctor.
That was the Doctor.
I don't know. It could be, but I think there's a missing scene, you know, that they couldn't afford to do.
Yeah.
he could have gone in his tank. That might still be in the TARDIS. Or he might have a moped in there still. A motorbike.
Yeah, yeah. There's all sorts of options, isn't there?
I think he could have speeded off. Or, banana splits type buggy. Which allows us to go...
La 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 la.
G'day there everyone, Dr. Robert here with the test results for the latest Doctor Who episode, Before the Flood. Now take a seat, this won't take long, probably about 5 to 6 minutes based on past episodes. What did I think about Before the Flood? Well, in a word, great. I really, really liked it. From that opening breaking the fourth wall bit where he's talking about Beethoven and giving big clues as to what the whole episode is about and how it will be solved, right through those opening credits with Capaldi playing the electric guitar over the top of them, I thought that was just fantastic. And it really was Capaldi too, by the way. That has been confirmed by the Radio Times. And into the episode itself, where all these great characters who, you know, so much care and attention and time was taken on fleshing them out in the first part, you know, we're really caring for them in the second part. I was really sad when O'Donnell got bumped off. It was a possibility that I'd already thought about, of course. In my predictions for this episode, I pondered whether the people who went back in time with the Doctor might end up brown bread, and O'Donnell did, sadly, because I quite liked her. I think Morven Christie's a great actor, and it would have been nice to see her pop up again at some stage in the show in some way, shape or form. She was obviously a big fan of the Doctor's. There were little hints. There were hints about the Minister for War. What's all that about? You know, is that a throwaway line, or is that going to become important later in the series, possibly in the Zygon stories, to take a wild punt? The character of the Fisher King himself was an interesting one, because as I'd been pointing out in the last time I spoke to you all, the Fisher King is a real-life myth on Earth, and I wondered how much of that might actually tie in. And in the end, it wasn't much. I mean, as we went through, the Fisher King had a magic cauldron. He could bring people back from the dead, but they couldn't speak. And obviously, in Doctor Who, we had people brought back from the dead, in the form of ghosts, at least, but they couldn't speak. But that's really where it ended, because this Fisher King came from, obviously, a far distant place to Earth. He wasn't human at all, and there was no real sort of ongoing story with him being on Earth. This was his arrival on Earth, and then he died. So, you know, it's not even like we can say, oh, he is the reason we have the Fisher King legend or anything, because he was in the wrong time era. He didn't spend much time on Earth, and so on and so forth. So that was a bit disappointing. It's a shame, in some ways, they even called him the Fisher King. They could have used some of the parts of the Fisher King story, but maybe not have called him that, perhaps. In terms of a monster, he was quite interesting. I didn't know whether I liked him or not, because he is the classic man in a suit, and that's quite cool and quite retro in some ways, and in some ways looks far more realistic than, you know, CGI. But at other times, when he's shambling across that disused army base or that training facility, I thought, how does this compare to, you know, a reasonably well-budgeted US TV show? And he was a bit lacking in that area. But, you know, that's small potatoes, because the whole story was more about the concept of how the Doctor could defeat this guy. And the way he did it, you know, prefaced at the very start of the episode, was believable, and all the bits were there from the start for us to see. Maybe a small quibble from me could be around how the ghost doctor, it was only a hologram, how a hologram was actually making, you know, things work on the base underwater. I'm not sure how that could be. Do they have solid holograms in Doctor Who now, like they have solid holograms in Red Dwarf, perhaps? I'm not sure. But again, it's small potatoes compared to the overall story, the characters we really cared for. I was so happy when Cass and her interpreter, Lun, was it, you know, finally admit their feelings for each other at the end, and the way that was done, that was quite nice. I mean, some people might see that as a soap opera element of Doctor Who, but I don't mind that kind of thing. You know, it wasn't the point of the story, it was just a nice part of the story. Clara was a very interesting character in this story, in the way that when she thought the Doctor might be going to die and just allow himself to die, was saying, you know, well, it was all about her, wasn't it? I can't quite remember what her exact words were, but it was all about him not leaving her because she wasn't ready, and it was all about her, when it's actually him, who's about to die, and probably who she should be thinking about a bit more than herself. But again, as we've said, and as other reviewers have said out there, this is all part of Clara's ultimate downfall. This is Clara, the adrenaline junkie, control freak, and so on. And that really just leaves Peter Capaldi to talk about. Peter Capaldi, you know, he's not my ultimate doctor, because I think my ultimate doctor is ultimately a combination of many, many things and can't be embodied by one person. But Capaldi does embody so many of the things I like in a doctor. You know, he's older, he's authoritarian. That's quite ironic, given Peter Davison is my doctor, who's neither of those things. But I digress. This was a great episode. It's 8 out of 10 for me, and again, I'm a hard marker, so that's a really great result. I can't say enough nice things about it. Did you like it? Why not write in and tell the show? hello@thedwshow.net. Ring with a friend, I said you called up a robber.
Hi, my name's Beth.
I'm Andy.
And I'm Kevin.
And we're going to talk a bit about Before the Flood, the latest episode of Doctor Who. So before we begin, I just want to say I was absolutely gutted that I didn't get to record with you, Andy, and Al last week about Under the Lake, because I absolutely loved that episode. I thought it was superb. So I know that you quite enjoyed it as well.
Very much.
I'd be interested, before we start talking about Before the Flood, just briefly finding out about what Kev thought about it, and then we can discuss how we felt about the second part of it. So, Kev.
Well, I really enjoyed it. I mean, it's probably one of the scariest episodes we've seen in since the series came back. I think, you know, they really went out to try and scare the kiddies and put something in there that, you know, probably the later time for it was a good thing, I think, because there was stuff in there that would have given some children nightmares and made them think twice. In terms of the story, I think it set things up really, really well. You know, the supporting cast were all excellently drawn. I just think there were what for me wasn't as good as the first two-parter, but I think the problem with the series this year is you're not going to be able to judge how good a story really is until you've seen both parts of it. But you know, it set up some interesting mysteries, and I'm interested to see how it goes forward this week.
So with that in mind, did you enjoy the conclusion as much as the first part, and how do you think it played out as a two-parter?
To be honest, I was disappointed. You know, I think since the Moffat has taken over on the series, you know, he tries to make the second part very different from the first part, and I think that's a brief that he's given to all of his writers that are writing on the series, and this was quite different from the first part in a lot of ways. But I just felt there was too much padding in it. There was too much running around. There was a whole load of plot holes that didn't really hang together very well. If anything, the bits back at the base were actually the best parts. And if we'd seen more of that and more dealing with the ghosts again, and a better resolution of that part of the plot, I would have been happier. The whole bit back in 1980 just didn't really do it for me. It didn't really go anywhere, to be honest. yeah, disappointing, I think, is what it was in summary.
Andy, what did you think?
I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. Last week, one of the things that struck me was sort of the feelings I got inside was that the essence of it reminded me of Doctor Who when I was little, which was things like Robots of Death and Ark in Space and all those Tom Baker ones. And I always liked the enclosed ones when they were on space stations or bases. But other ones that I really loved were things like really bizarre one to really love, but Sontar and Experiment, because it reminded me of the places I used to go out and play when I was little. You know, these disused railway tracks where there was maybe old random buildings and stuff. And that second episode did that for me with the locations. I thought the design was amazing in the first episode, but were these buildings actually together that they'd found earlier? I was trying to find it online to see where they'd filmed it, but just the actual locations looked stunning. I thought they were brilliant. Didn't know anything whatsoever about the Cold War aspect of it being part of it, which was interesting. Maybe not explored as much as possible, but I liked the feelings it gave me. I enjoyed it. I suppose in some respects it was a sort of a bit of a Scooby-Doo ending, wasn't it? The ending came very quickly after the duration of the episode. The sort of like the resolution with sticking the sunglasses in and there again and putting them on people's heads to erase their memories and things. That all seemed very quick and all very happy and, you know, all they needed at the end of it was all patting each other on the backs and going, ha, 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 He-Man style, and that would have been perfect, wouldn't it? But, I think that came very fast at the end, but the actual episode itself, I liked the way it balanced with the first one. It was different, and I liked it. What about you, Beth?
I lean closer towards what Kev's been saying, if I'm perfectly honest. I wasn't crazy about it, and I think part of that's because I loved last week's episode so much. It was a real classic Base Under Siege in the Troughton vein, which I really enjoyed. And then I knew that taking it out of that base and out of that claustrophobic space would probably end up with me being a bit biased against it. But I actually did have quite a few problems with it. Aside from that, I thought the location design was fantastic. I agree with you guys on that. I didn't think very much was made of the nods to the Cold War. I didn't like the pacing of it very much. Whereas last week just seemed to move perfectly, this week it just sort of went quick, slow, quick, quick, slow, slow, and there were certain elements that weren't given enough time and other elements that we just spent far too long on. And I found myself getting bored or frustrated that I hadn't seen the things I wanted to see. And I think the biggest failing for me, apart from, I'm going to disagree with you guys here, the design of the Fisher King. Not the design of the Fisher King, the execution of the Fisher King. I really liked the concept art that we could see in the Fisher King that we had, but for practical reasons, clearly they could only use foam rubber. So when he's walking through wind, it all looks a little bit wobbly. For some reason, the texture just looked a bit unfinished to me, and it looked almost as though someone had just gone, oh no, we've run out of time, let's go and get the prototype that we've made of this character and stick it on the actor because we haven't managed to finish it. And aside from that, the biggest problem for me was the ending where Bennett, who up until then had been one of my favourite characters, was going to have his mind erased, and because he was so lovelorn for O'Donnell, who he'd been pining for goodness knows how many years, who he was now just staring at in the Faraday cage, he turns to Lun and says, you know, you've got to tell Cass how you feel. And I'd really love it if we could have one work environment in Doctor Who where people aren't in love with each other. Just a little bit of professionalism wouldn't go amiss.
I won't even go on work nights out.
But
if I've got money to spend, they'll say, why are you coming to this Christmas do? And I said, because if I go out, I want to go out with my friends.
But it seems like everyone was coupled up in either unrequited love or secret will they, won't they love, and it felt more like an 80s sitcom Mm. You know, it was very much Cheers or Moonlighting rather than Doctor Who.
But Beth, do you think that at least with Cass and Lun, it had been telegraphed in the previous episode? You could see some of the exchanges between them, that there was obviously some kind of relationship bubbling under the surface there. The whole bit where Cass wouldn't let him go into the hearse to see the writing that was on the wall a couple of times, and the exchange in this episode when she didn't want him to leave the Faraday cage.
I didn't think it was sinister. I thought it was a matter of professionalism. She was at that point the senior officer. He was a translator. He's not an officer. He's not a technician. He's not a scientist. He's there as a translator. That's his role. And therefore, it's not appropriate for him to go into the dangerous bits. He's there as a translator. So why would he need to go in there?
This is, I think what's happening here is that, This is how Doctor Who works for different audiences, though, isn't it? Because maybe they were aiming at the rom-com audience there and we just haven't picked up on it because we were more interested in other aspects of it, perhaps. I don't know. Is this the Heat magazine thing? Is this the Billy Piper RTD thing coming back? I don't know. Bringing love
maybe
into
it's
it.
Because I hate love.
Kevin, do you like a rom-com?
I do like a rom-com, but please don't call me a Heat reader.
Apologies to any international listeners. Who don't know what heat is. and congratulations to any UK listeners who don't know what Heat is. It's a gossip magazine in the United Kingdom, effectively.
It was featured in episode one. It was featured in Rose, though.
Of course it was, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
It was, yeah. But, I mean, I at least felt with the end of the episode when, you know, when they got together and they kissed and everything, that there had been something in the background going on there with, you know, with O'Donnell and Bennett. There was nothing, really. That came completely out of left field that all of a sudden, oh, he was in love with her, so he had to tell the other two that you've got to make the best of your chances. I didn't see that coming at all, and it felt very fake.
Some respects, we should have expected there to be a specific connection between Lun and Cass, not necessarily a romantic one, but because of all the people who she lives and works with, he is the only one she can communicate clearly with. And that's why they've got that connection. And there doesn't have to be a romantic subtext to it. But that's just my opinion. Although Andy mentioned canon.
Ooh.
Shall we talk about the obliteration of the fourth wall at the beginning for a bit?
Oh, I'd love to talk about that. Who was he talking to?
Yeah.
Well, at one point when he mentioned the bootstrap paradox to Clara, I was thinking, well, is the beginning actually the very, very end where he explains the bootstrap paradox to Clara? But then if you look at the camera work, it's not her POV, and it's most reminiscent of In the Forest of the Night when he's talking to the children.
Mm. My problem with it was that it felt comfortable to start with because I thought what would happen is, well, the way we'd left it from last week's cliffhanger was that he was on board the TARDIS with two other travellers from the base, but he wasn't evidently at that point because I thought what would happen, we'll pan around to them looking, you know, looking a bit gormless and thinking, oh yeah, I'll see what he's on about. But we didn't get that. And then I thought, was he talking to Clara then? But evidently not, because the camera just stayed on him and he was really, really goofing to camera at some points by the end of it. And I was starting to really think, who are you talking to? Is it me?
Yeah. It's not like, he's done this before. He did it in Listen, didn't he? When he started asking those questions to camera. But this was like him reaching through the screen and slapping you around the face with it.
But
and then once we got to the whole bit where he gets his guitar out and playing that in the middle of the TARDIS, I was just like,
well,
there's
talking to yourself is one thing, and I know we've got this potential single hander coming up, and that keeps reminding me of the time Victor Meldrew did a single hander in One Foot in the Grave, and it was absolutely fantastic. And Hancock used to do it, and they would talk to themselves. Mm.
Doc Cotton's
done it as well. Yeah, this was talking to them, but this is proper Lovejoy looking to camera and talking to us. This is proper, you know, goofing to camera.
Kev, you mentioned the guitar, which he then pulled out, and we went into the opening theme.
Oh, yes. I get that that Peter Capaldi is, you know, used to be in a band, and I get that he likes all this. Yeah, he sees himself, his doctor was a bit of a punk doctor. And the guitar was fine in the episode, in the first episode with the tank and everything like that. And it, yeah, very funny. Yeah, bored with it now. And also, I don't think the guitar worked over the theme music at all. It, you know, it's completely at odd with the version that we've got now, you know, Murray Gold's screeching version of the theme, as I called it, which I don't like at all. And it's a bit of ho, 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 aren't we funny? Look what we've done here. But I'm not dying to ever hear it again.
Well, I'll tell you what. I thought it's reaching out. I didn't think it should have had the guitar in an episode again. I thought that was done and dusted, and it's maybe something that shouldn't be returned to, and you move on, because I think that's what the Doctor's mind's like. He doesn't sort of go back to these things. But then I thought, it's appealing to a different kind of fandom. It's appealing to a different audience. I could really imagine, a group of 20-somethings and, you know, loving that, sat in their halls of residence and really getting into it. I could imagine that. But I did actually love the Guitar version of the theme tune, because I do like Guitar version of the theme tune. As a one-off, it shouldn't happen ever again. as a one-off, yeah, I liked it. I like it when they do little tricky things like that. And I did say, "No way, man," when it came on. Which I make no apologies for.
What about you, Beth?
I didn't like it. But did you know it was Peter Capaldi playing?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
I've got to admit, even though they put articles up saying that, I take that with a huge pinch of salt. He might have twanged a string or two, but I have a feeling that there's a lot of overdubs. There was a lot of overdubs in a recording studio.
So one thing I wanted to ask is, what did anybody think of the bits where they, you know, foreshadowed episodes yet to come?
Minister of War, was it?
Yeah, that's right.
I actually felt a bit Christmassy when there was that scene when she was jumping up and down saying it's bigger on the inside, because I've had a little bit of a cold, and I normally have a cold at Christmas and when the Doctor Who special's on. So I felt a little bit Christmassy and excited when she was saying that, and then she name-checked some companions and Harold Saxon and then mentioned the War Minister. I don't know. I've grown a bit when they foreshadow things. I'm not into arcs, and I'd just rather watch a story, to tell you the truth, and not have to spend time guessing the twist or guessing things. I'd rather just watch it and it happen.
Do you think that's an RTD kind of throw in where, you know, it's just it just throws a line in and never mentions it ever again, like the scar of degradations and things like that in the Time War? Or do you think that's Moffat adding something in because it's part of the story?
A Moffat story arc is different from an RTD story arc, because an RTD story arc normally lasted a series, whereas a Moffat story arc, you might not find out who the War Minister is for 2 years, or 3 years for all we know. He might be referenced again at Christmas, and we might not know until the end. Who knows with Moffat?
He does like a long game, doesn't he?
Definitely. In fact, I know people say he's very clever, and of course he knows who all these people are he references. But sometimes, you know, I think if I was a writer on a TV show, I'd challenge myself and think, oh, I'm going to throw something in here and then I'll come back to it, because it means that I've got a concept or something to hang my story on in the future. So I'm going to, let's just call it the War Minister. Yeah, we'll come back to him. It's like, what was the Yellow Dalek called and the Dalek Paradigm? Wasn't he called... The Eternal. And they said, one day we'll find out what that means. I don't think we will now. But, you know, I think they throw these things in to sort of, almost as a hook for them, really, if they ever come to a writer's meeting and go, what about that thing we mentioned that time? Let's bring it in.
I think Moffat just likes, you know, poking a stick in the fan cage every now and again and stirring things up. You know, he puts in lines like, oh, you know, the master or mistress has got a daughter, and he knows that, you know, half the internet's going to explode over that, and then he thinks, oh, he's just sitting there laughing to himself, knowing, oh, I've done that, and now they're going to get really annoyed with me, or they're really going to like it, and he doesn't really care one way or the other. He's just doing it for himself for a bit of fun.
Yeah, I think so.
There was something else I wanted to ask.
Go on.
quite a lot was made of Corey Taylor's involvement in this episode, in the run-up. Everyone getting it almost shoved down their throats that the singer from Slipknot was going to be providing vocals.
Mm.
Did you guys really think that the hype was worth it on that?
I don't think it was just him to me. And I'm going to sound really, really naive here, because me and Al had the conversation about him last week and forgot his name as well. But you've got the first guy who was killed, the guy who
Moran.
We later realised had been in, Batman, and he'd been in Black Books, and he was quite a big actor.
Mm.
Whose face, you know, that's why we was kicking ourselves, because he's a really big actor, he's a proper actor. And they killed him really early on. Well, but it was the same with this episode with Dennis Pennis.
Paul K, he was barely in it.
And it's the same with the Slipper guy. It's the same as Fox's last series. It seems to be that, you know, is there a lot on the cutting room floor? I don't know.
And the voice of the speaking voice of the Fisher King was Peter Serafinowicz as well, who really only had 3 or 4 lines, which was a bit
was
of a
it
surprise.
Really?
It was Peter. Yeah, it was the voice of Darth Maul.
Right. Okay. So what did
you
say?
Do you think
then?
it's
Slipknot guy? What did he do?
He just screamed.
Is that it?
It was just
the roar of
the
Fisher
King.
Unless again,
was so processed that it could be anyone screaming.
Yeah, back in the JNT era, he used to get lots of people from Light Entertainment, didn't he? And he, you know, was always out there trying to, oh, if I attract these people to come on the show, it gets more publicity for the show, and the more publicity, it's that same kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, appealing to a slightly different demographic.
Yeah, I think Ken Dodd was probably the best example who's like that, because he was only in the beginning of episode one, wasn't he? Remind me, not Paradise Towers, the one where the Delta and the Bannerman.
Delta and the Bannerman.
Yeah, he was only at the beginning of that, whereas other people like Richard Bryce were throughout a whole story. But yeah, he's like a really good case in point there, that he was just in basically a cameo, wasn't it? Hale and Pierce in Survival, you know, cameo.
Mm.
Well, they weren't in it for their talent as actors, Beth.
But I would say that Nicholas Parsons in...
I love Nicholas Parsons.
Nicholas Parsons is great.
That was more
than the cameo, and he was absolutely marvellous in it.
Mm, he was.
In Curse of Fenric, he was really good.
Yeah.
Mm.
I think we've wandered far enough off topic from before the flood to say maybe it's time to thank you both very much for joining me, and... say good night, or good morning for anyone listening in the morning.
Goodbye to all of you at home.
Goodbye, and thank you very much for having me on the show.
Last time there was a character from Tivoli. It was David Walliams. And David Walliams and Paul Kay were an artistic duo together in Spaced. They were Vulva and Hoover. And I just keep thinking that that's a brilliant link.
It's not finished.
Now it's finished.
Hello, guys, and it's Lizzie here. And I'm here with Alicia again.
Woohoo!
Yay! So today we're going to be talking about the latest episode of Doctor Who.
Yay! Lessons.
Which I've actually forgotten the name of. Is it Under the Flood? Or is it After the Flood or Before the Flood? It's something with the flood.
It's something with
so
H2O.
Something with water. We're
H2O.
On the same wavelength there. H2O.
That's H2O.
More scientific. Okay, yeah. So what did you think of the introduction with Beethoven? We have to speak about that.
At first I was confused because I was like, Wait, no.
No, what the hell?
Yeah. I was literally like that first, and then I like the fact he was explaining the paradox theory.
Yeah.
With the fact someone else could create the same music and the same effect would happen.
Yeah.
Although I like the fact Doctor Who is Beethoven, ladies and gentlemen. He is a genius.
But I loved the bit with the guitar. I adored that.
I
love
that.
Yes, guitar.
I've got the exact same guitar.
Turn up the guitar. I'm nicking that for a cosplay.
I know you are.
But I loved the rock introduction, which is actually a rock version of the theme tune. But a lot of people hated it.
Why? It's so good.
They hated it.
It's talent, people, embrace it.
And it was actually Peter Capaldi playing that intro. I think so.
Again, people, talent. You get
Capaldi.
That on a, you get a Capaldi talent, and also you get tank talent, for God's sake.
Fish tank talent.
Yes, exactly. Fish tank.
So, Fisher King. What did you think of the creature?
It looked like something out of Resident Evil, to be honest. Literally, that's all I kept thinking. It looked something like that monster from Resident Evil, but I thought the monster was actually really good. I liked the gruesome effects, especially the
mouth.
The mouth. It was weird. It looked like some sort of swollen, like,
thing.
Bashy thing. I don't know. Bashy thing. I can't really say rude things, but it looks like a bashy thing.
But, I thought it was a genius concept. I thought it was brilliant. The fact that there's actually a creature taller than the Doctor, taller than Peter Capaldi. So if Peter Capaldi's looking at the creature scared as hell, I just thought it was brilliant. The fact that the Doctor was actually brought to his knees kind of thing.
Well, he's more bent over a table.
Well, bent over a table. But
that's a new expression for the Doctor. That is very new.
So, Clara.
Everyone knows my opinion on Clara, but I think for this episode she was a bit, again, whiny, although saying that, you would be in the same situation if you saw, you know, the guy that took you to a different time and dimension. Just
dead
outside the window. So yeah, I would have some sort of, you know, oh God, he's dead. No. But I like the fact Clara was actually a bit level-headed this time in some areas. Although I still don't like her.
I still don't like her either.
No one likes Clara.
Apart from the Doctor.
Apart from the Doctor and some fans.
Yay.
I'm looking at you fans in, like, question glaze, but, you know. Sorry, that's, like, Primark. We're in Primark at the moment. We're in the cheap area.
Oh, God.
Customer services, scanning.
So, the deaf people, what did you think?
I think the deaf concept was really good. I liked the fact when she went to the floor and did some sort of daredevil trick where she could feel the vibrations and she pitched it in her mind. Yeah. I liked that. Cause at the same time, though, I was thinking that's a bit of a copy thing from Daredevil, but I like the concept of where how she could escape from that. Although the one thing I am upset about in the entire episode is the fact that that guy didn't get back together with the...
That made me upset. I cried at that. Wasn't fair. So we're going to have to cut this review a bit short, unfortunately. Ignore the music in the background.
It's a go with the mood.
Yes, we're in a shopping centre at the moment. So out of 10.
1,000,000.5, 0.6, 0.8, 0.9, Doctor Who.
I'd maybe give it a 6.
6?
A 6. That's
six?
Being generous.
You had
generous.
A bloody thing that pushed the Doctor on the table when you found out it was Beethoven. What the hell's wrong with you?
But anyway, guys, we've got to go, but I'll speak to you later. And thank you very much for listening. Goodbye!
Bye-bye!
I'm the me.
And I'm the him, I suppose. Hi, well, we've just finished watching Before the Flood. Yeah, Bootstrap Paradox.
Yeah, I feel like I've mentioned that at some point before.
Yeah.
At great length.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you did. I think it was Listen last year, wasn't it?
Was it?
Mm.
Was that what I went on about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
Why would that have
worked in? I don't know. So the Beethoven, the bit at the start when there weren't enough walls in the TARDIS. Did you want to say anything about that? Because you
too many walls.
Too many walls. Yeah, because the fourth wall was well and truly missing there.
Yeah, that was bizarre. That bit. What was that?
What was that about?
Merry Christmas to all you at home.
Well, sort of. Yeah. It was kind of in a way lifting from. Obviously, it's just an illustration of the paradox and how it works, But it was very reminiscent of, I can't remember if it was a time twister or if it was just a future shot, but it was in 2000 AD, and it was about the guy who wrote Shakespeare's plays, mm-hmm. and that was in there. But that wasn't the only 2000 AD story that felt reminiscent of. The other one was Chronocops by Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons, which was almost referenced exactly at one point in there when they were hiding behind the... the toxic waste cans. But there we go. Okay, the theme was definitely heavier. The music was different, wasn't it?
Oh, yes.
In fact, I think Murray Gold's done more versions of the Doctor Who theme than anyone else, seeing as he does 12 a year by the sounds of it.
He doesn't tell anyone.
He doesn't tell anyone, no.
Does Murray Gold do the theme music?
Yeah. I think he changes the arrangements, yeah.
I would have thought they'd have brought in...
Someone else?
Yeah.
Corey Taylor from Slipknot.
Ipnot,
yeah,
and Stone Sour.
I was a little disappointed he didn't go full cookie for that one, but there we go. Did you recognise Peter Serafinovich? He was the voice of the Fisher King. The guy who did Darth Maul.
Did that do Darth Vader? No, Darth Vader was the Green Cross.
Yeah, Dave Prowse, but he was voiced by Simba's dad, James Earl Jones. Yeah, because otherwise it would have been, you are a member of the Rebel Alliance and a traitor, take her away!
But did he not do the voice initially, and then they dubbed over him?
Yeah, and he was just kind of like, I can't understand why they changed my voice. Anyway, so the Minister of War is going to be coming up, we haven't seen that one yet.
Well, that might not be coming up for a very long time.
It might not be.
That might be, you know, an extreme trapdoor.
I'd give it 3 weeks. I think Clara's very dead. I think she's very doomed. She's kind of...
You thought that last year.
Well, because she was doomed last year, but Jenna Coleman saved her. The way she behaved in that was not... It wasn't good, and O'Donnell should not have died. O'Donnell's death was really stupid.
I get your point, but your wording could be better. She had to die, but of the four cardinal directions available for her to check... She luckily didn't look behind her in the tiny room she'd just come out of. She didn't look in front of her, because that was a wall. But she chose to look to the left, despite it being a dead end, and not to the right, where it was open.
It was ridiculous. It obviously stopped walking right behind her. That bit wasn't very well done.
No, the thing is that it walked away. It walked away.
It stopped...
And then it ninja'd its way back.
I thought it was standing behind it. I thought the Fish King was really good.
Walks with a purpose.
Walks with a purpose. It did walk with a definite purpose, didn't it, rather than a porpoise. It was interesting to see that Paul K. paid Prentice as Mark Gatiss.
Yes.
As a sort of a league of gentlemen character, maybe. But
just a general Mark Gatiss.
It felt like Mark Gatiss, didn't it?
Yeah. I'm surprised it wasn't, to be honest.
Yeah, and I was a little bit disappointed with the with Prentice's death scene, where for some reason they put the wrong track by Murray Gold on. It was to play the wrong music over it.
Yeah, that was bizarre. The death scenes in general are bizarre. What's he doing to them? Is he flicking them to death?
I don't know. We never found out. There was like a kind of a rumble, and that was it. It was,
and it's just like, well, what happened?
Well, we don't
what
know.
What did he do?
We don't know.
Why does Prentice die immediately when they have no wounds, no burn marks? Their clothing isn't damaged. You know, the doctor, you know, maybe doing a rugby tackle did more damage to his clothing than the Fisher King could ever do.
Yeah. Well, I'm not a big fan of Slipknot, so I'm not going to say anything here.
Ipnot.
O'Donnell was listing, when she was listing Martha and Rose and everything, she was going through things that really kind of helps sort of cement the fact that this is the new Who-niversary at the moment, that we're looking at the last 10 years of Doctor Who as much as anything else. So this is a kind of a celebratory season of the last 10 years, I think. And I think that came through very definitely there. I thought Capaldi was brilliant. I thought, again, the acting was excellent throughout. But I don't think it was quite as successful as last week's. Although, brilliant. It was still very, very good indeed.
This is what I don't get. You can't actually seem to decide whether you liked it or not. First of all, you made like this face after it was done, which, you know, made it look like you wanted to kill it to bits.
Mm-hmm.
And then you were like, it was great, it was awesome.
Yeah, but however, there were a couple of offbeats in that. The stuff that happened to O'Donnell, that was wrong.
I feel like that was, I think that was more bad directing than script writing. Well, I think in the script that, you know, that would have been salvageable.
I think it probably just said peril monkey turns here, and that would have been about it, because there was no...
The thing is, though, right, is that she was dead regardless the second that it knew she was there.
Well,
she was not getting out, right?
Mm-hmm.
But instead of devoting, like, 2 minutes to it, with her trying to hide or whatever, they just ended it like that, which is bizarre, but as far as the script went, and as far as the scene and the set went, she was dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's true. The bit with Moran pursuing Cass down the corridors, I thought that was quite well done, but I also thought that went on a bit too long. Although the sound design was nice, and we didn't really need the Photoshop effect to show us how she sees things through sound.
Yeah, I don't really...
Or vibration, even.
That did go on for quite a while, but I was kind of disappointed that they didn't use the effect of the ghosts in the dark more often, because it's really good, because they just sort of appear.
It was creepy, still very creepy.
Because the first thing you see is the axe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Despite the fact that the axe is behind him, because he's see-through.
Yeah. It was... Very, very good. Very good. Not as good as last week's, but I think the two of them together make a really strong story. I thought that was pretty cool. Okay, so I think probably... and Clara is definitely doomed. On that bombshell, see you next week.
You don't want to make stagnant pond noises.
You know, I think there's something potentially scandalous brewing around Doctor Who Series 9, and it relates directly to the ratings, but not in the way you might think. So put down your weapon of choice, regardless of what side you're on in that debate, and just bear with me for a moment. You see, every series of Doctor Who, the overnight ratings come in for the first few episodes, and unless they're on par with the highest overnight ratings for new whoever, someone, somewhere in fandom declares, well, that's not as good as it used to be, and a fandom turf war breaks out, with one side seemingly more interested in the ratings than what's actually happening on telly. Now, such a turf war, well, I say turf war, but it's more like wet celery at five paces when you look at the average Doctor Who fan. It usually lasts for months longer than the series is even on TV that particular year, and one is going on right now with regard to Series 9. You see, the overnights in the UK for the first three episodes of this series have been The Magician's Apprentice at 4.58 million, The Witch's Familiar at 3.7 million, and Under the Lake at 3.7 million. Now, these figures are quite low at face value, but of course, when you factor in the changing face of television, most notably an increasing amount of time shifting by viewers, and also look at what Doctor Who's been up against, including live World Cup rugby currently being hosted in the UK for those who aren't familiar with the sport, the figures are really no surprise at all. Indeed, even before Under the Lake aired, I was talking with some fellow fans, and it was a case of not if the ratings would be creamed, but, to be honest, by how much. We took no pleasure in the conversation, of course, we're not sadists. It was simply an intellectual exercise, acknowledging what was going to happen before it had even happened. Such was the obviousness of the situation. And what was that situation? Well, to add more detail, again for those who don't follow the sport, England was fighting to keep its place in the whole contest. No host nation had ever been knocked out of the World Cup so early, were they to lose. And it was also up against a traditional rival in the form of my boys, the Australian Wallabies. Now, there's not many people out there, I can tell you now, who, if they like rugby, or even if they have a passing interest in the game, would prefer to ignore that, or, you know, maybe watch it on replay, rather than miss Doctor Who for a couple of hours. And it's those people, watching Doctor Who at other times because of the rugby or some other reason, who are important, you see. Because once all the other ways of viewing the episodes were factored in within that 1 week period,
Magicians actually had an overall rating of 6.54 million and Witches had 5.71 million. I don't have Under the Lake's final figures here to hand at the time of recording, but it was likely much better, much more respectable than its overnight as well. But, they say, the first three episodes of Series 8 had final figures of Deep Breath at 9.17 million, Into the Dalek at 7.29, and Robot of Sherwood at 7.28 million. So, in comparison, Series 9 has dropped a bit, no matter how you slice and dice it. Not a huge amount, once you remove Deep Breath in particular as a bit of an aberration, being the debut episode of A New Doctor. But it's certainly a fair comment, and I'm not going to try and white knight the situation either. I think that would be disrespectful to anyone who progressed beyond, I don't know, primary school mathematics. But with Australia knocking England out of the World Cup while Under the Lake was on the weekend before last, there might be an immediate small rise in the ratings, starting from the story we're discussing this episode, Before the Flood. And further, with the World Cup final on October 31st, all of November and December's Doctor Who is going to be rugby free. That will be a really interesting time, I think, in terms of overnights and final ratings. Even the biggest pessimist would have to assume the ratings will be going up to some degree, with so many freed up viewers on the prowl for something to watch. Which just leaves one question: how much will Doctor Who's ratings go up in a post-Rugby World Cup world? Well, only time will tell. I'm not Nostradamus. But it's already got me thinking, folks. If the rugby ending doesn't give enough of an appreciable bounce for some reason, and if those final figures remain low, or at least lower than we're used to, then are we facing a situation where this could be a very, very good series of Doctor Who, but not seen by as many people as possible when it first goes out? I mean, already the AI, or appreciation index of each episode, is up around the 83s and 84s, I'm led to believe, and internally at the BBC, I think an AI of 85 is regarded to be excellent. So Doctor Who is being loved. It's knocking on the door of excellent AIs. So, you know, could it mean that later on people will look back on Series 9 of Doctor Who and it might start to become a bit of a cult classic? Honestly, although this thinking involves Doctor Who having lower ratings for the rest of the series, I'm already thinking along those lines. And the key reason being that the first three episodes have been great. There hasn't been a series in the Moffat era where I've actually liked all three of the opening episodes, and if my feelings about Before the Flood are correct, I'm going to have really liked the first four. Obviously, I'm recording this before I've seen it. And you know, that's one third of the series without any real misstep. And that's got to be no coincidence. So given this is likely the style and the tone for the whole series, it could easily be the best series of Moffat's reign so far. Yet, could it be seen, at least initially, by the smallest number of people? There are, of course, a lot of ifs and buts and maybes in what I'm saying. Who knows, the two-parter with Maisie Williams might be horrible, but I doubt it. We might all be calling the Zygon story stupid in a few more weeks. But that seems unlikely. And the final episodes all point towards something pretty damn major and exciting going on. I've just got this feeling, deep down, that we might be sitting on the best overall series of Doctor Who in a long time. Better than Series 8 by far, way better than that horrible Series 7B, better than 7A, and so on. But what a scandal. How scandalous that we have a brilliant Doctor in a series that's kicking more goals than it has for a long time, but less people are watching.
And next time on Doctor Who, when Vikings attack. Yeah, that looks like a lot of fun to me. I don't believe I've ever seen Vikings on Doctor Who before, so should be interesting.
You know, there's not a whole lot to grab onto in the next time. There could be a bit of comedy. I think one of them dropped his sword and then banged his head. That was quite amusing.
And what do you think? What do we think of the next time trailer?
I've already forgotten it, but I feel like I had stuff to say on it when I watched it.
All right. It looks good. It looks interesting. We'll see what happens.
I've genuinely forgotten it completely.
Vikings.
I'm gonna steal from the best. I'm gonna do what Al would do. I'm gonna sum my feelings for next episode up in a noise, and that noise is
Yes, I was looking for the helmets.
Ah,
I didn't
to see if they got them wrong.
Yes, and I didn't see any. I only saw one, as I recall.
I think it's Vikings from Space.
I'm just really looking forward to seeing what Maisie Williams is doing and why she's so important to the Doctor.
You have been hearing Andy, Beth, Al, Rob, Little Burr, The Him, Lizzie, Alicia, Ian, Kate and Lex. You can find out all about us at the dwshow.net and find us on Twitter and Facebook by searching the DW Show, that's with a capital D and a capital W, and you can email us at hello@thedwshow.net. The DW is in capitals. Our theme tune is by Dominic Glynn and is available as part of the Gallifrey Mixes on Amazon and iTunes. Thanks for listening.